This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Paddy. Well, last week, Pitbull tweeted out his contract with Visit Florida. That's the state's tourism promotion agency. The rapper has been paid up to $1 million to promote the Sunshine State. His song Sexy Beaches includes lyrics like, I want to see sexy beaches and hotels, and I don't bring sand to the beach, I bring the beach to the sand. Well, Visit Florida CEO Will Seckham said the deal was a good deal for Florida, but it has cost him his job. Governor Rick Scott called on him to resign, saying taxpayers had a right to know how their money is spent. And here's some sound of Will Seckham talking to 90.7 at the end of last year about this deal.
A guy that has an extraordinary influence among his passionate fans, a guy that's passionate about the state of Florida, and a real alignment there. So we started working with him and looking at opportunities for us to tap into that passion that Pitbull has and the passion that his fans have for him.
So that's Will Seckham talking to 90.7 News back in November 2015 about the secret contract with Pitbull. Well, we're joined by economic analyst Hank Fishkind. Thank you for coming in, Hank.
Thank you.
Also joined by political analyst Frank Torres. Thanks for joining us, Frank.
Great to be here.
Hank, let me start with you. Seckham has been essentially fired over this deal, but in the meantime, tourism numbers to Florida have boomed while he's been the leader of Visit Florida. Was he unfairly let go?
I don't think so. I think there is a problem with transparency and governance. That said, we shouldn't confuse transparency and governance issues with the economic effectiveness of the tourism promotion. They're not the same things.
Can you expand on that a little bit? What do you mean by that?
Sure. Visit Florida was founded in 1996 to replace the Florida Department of Commerce to promote tourism in this state. Tourism is one of the most important industries in the state. There's fierce international and within the country competition, and so we need to promote tourism. It's cost effective. It generates $6 billion of sales tax revenue for the state, 24% of the total revenue. Obviously, this is something that's critically important to our state's economy.
Did the Department of Commerce, the forerunner of Visit Florida, was that only for promotion of tourism, or did it do other things as well?
No, it did many other things, but it promoted tourism as well.
Well, let me ask you this, Hank Fishkind. How much credit can Visit Florida take for boosting those tourism numbers?
It can take some credit. I haven't seen any direct studies of Visit Florida's effectiveness, but I've studied tourism in convention centers all around the state and many in other states of this country, and there is a very clear relationship between the amount spent on promotion and the number of visitors and the amounts that they spend.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, let me bring you in on the conversation. Visit Florida has been under pressure for some time to reveal the terms of this deal, this contract with Pitbull. I mean, if Pitbull hadn't gone ahead and tweeted out to people what he was paid by the state, would that tourism promotion arm still be in trouble anyway?
Yeah, it still would be a trouble here because it's a new day in the Florida legislature. You're talking about the Richard Corcoran controlled House, a speaker of the House that has laid out a whole slate of reforms involving transparency and fair play across the board. And he filed a lawsuit over the revealing of this contract, and Rick Scott was backing him up. The contract that was released last year was heavily redacted and heavily edited. So I think it was more of a call for transparency and more data available to everyday people, especially the taxpayers who are spending their money about this. I think it was more about that than it was about actually Pitbull and the money spent to him.
The Tampa Bay Times pointed out that Rick Scott also signed into law a couple of bills in 2016 offering even more protection for trade secrets this year. Richard Corcoran voted for those bills. So what do you make of the furore over this deal now, you know, so long after it was struck?
You know, I think it just falls in line to where the Florida House is right now. Corcoran in previous weeks has laid out a bunch of extra lobbying restrictions, extra procedures for filing bills, things that are attached to money. And Visit Florida's budget will once again be a source of controversy this year because it is so difficult to measure how effective they are when, you know, a lot of the resorts and attractions in the state seem to market themselves. We're one of the most visited places in the world. So it's very difficult to draw that measurement of success between the Visit Florida funds and how actually effective they are at actually bringing people into the state.
Hank Fishkind, is that where the economist steps in and says, well, look, we do actually have some tools to figure out just how effective the public money spent on promoting Florida is?
Sure. I mean, as Frank says, it's not easy, but yes, there are tools. Yes, there is a huge academic literature. Yes, there is a huge professional applied literature. It's very consistent that promotion works. I mean, we know advertising works. We know celebrity matters. I mean, look at this last election we just finished. The question isn't whether it works. The question is, are we spending the right amount of money? Are we getting a good return on the investment that we're making in public dollars? And that needs to be clearly laid out and made transparent so people will make the right decisions and can support or not, as they choose, with data.
Hank Fishkinder, I wonder if you could explain a little bit the pros and cons of trade secrets, and especially when it involves some money that you're spending. I mean, obviously, Visit Florida is a public-private partnership, so it's not all taxpayer money, but there is a significant chunk of that from the taxpayer. How do you then justify trade secrets in this context?
Well, you justify it, and you understand that 34% of the money you get, $74 million last year, is public money. Don't spend that on trade secrets. You got $144 million of private money. Spend that on the trade secrets.
Is it possible to kind of do that, though? I mean, can you divide it up so you don't spend public money on things that involve trade secrets?
Yes, you can. And if you can't do that, then don't enter into those kind of deals when you're receiving some public money. It's that clear and simple. And that's what has to happen here, Matt.
Frank Torres, should other agencies be nervous besides Visit Florida? I mean, this war on a lack of transparency, if you want to call it that, are other state agencies going to be looking at this and saying we could be next?
They certainly should. I think this should raise some red flags, not just with Visit Florida tourism agencies, but also economic development agencies that have also been called into question over the amounts of their budgets in previous years. And I think it is about access. I think the frustration came here when there was some pushback against the information that was being requested by lawmakers and some taxpayer watchdog groups. I don't think the debate was really over, you know, the money spent on Pitbull, somebody who's a known endorser, you know, who's synonymous with a party good time. He's done beer commercials. He's a heck of an advocate for the state. He's familiar with Rick Scott and Marco Rubio. He's taking selfies with both of them. Mm-hmm. So the real problem here is, show us what you're doing with our money. Yeah, you might not be able to measure it right now, but we still want to know, to the best of your ability, to your organization abilities, what you're spending this money on.
Do you think, though, people in Florida, the general public, would have been happy with that if they'd known from the get-go that $1 million was being spent on this contract?
You know, it's interesting because everybody interprets the product differently. The product here is a celebrity. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to have a lot of people that are, you know, north of middle age that don't have a clue who Pitbull is. They probably believe that it's probably an actual Pitbull that the dollars are being spent towards. But meanwhile, you've got that younger group, that key demo that we're trying so hard to hit with that, you know, expendable income that Pitbull resonates from. So it really is a difference of lenses, you know, involving the age, where you're from, and what kind of music you listen to.
Hank Fishkind, what about this idea of if you have somebody like Pitbull who is already so synonymous with a particular part of Florida, his nickname is Mr. 305, and as he pointed out himself, he's been promoting Florida long before this contract was signed, and he'll do so long after. I mean, can you then say that the state of Florida or the tourism promotion agency is getting a good deal when it's spending money on something that somebody's already doing?
Well, he's already doing it, but he could do a lot more. He could make it a lot more focused, and he would claim that that's what he did. So then the question would become, go out and measure the results. And so instead of just blindly criticizing it, yeah, it's good, it's bad, get some data so that we can all have at least some common foundation to have a much more adult discussion about this.
How would you gather that data?
Well, it's gathered both with surveys and using statistical and econometric techniques. And there's a wide variety of agreement amongst professionals of to what tool to use. And you'd want some pretty overwhelming results because there is a significant amount of uncertainty, as Frank said. So you don't want something that, you know, only 10% difference. You need, you know, some pretty broad effectiveness. Mm-hmm. But in other tourism studies I've done and others have done, we do find significant multipliers, like 5 and 10 times effects relative to the dollars. That'd be the kind of thing you'd look for to either accept or reject that this was a good contract, Matt.
So it's going to some folks who are visiting Florida and just saying, was the Pitbull video sexy beaches, or was the idea that some of Pitbull's tweets about, hey, come to Florida, it's a great place to visit, is that what encouraged you to make that trip?
Well, it's not nearly that easy. I mean, some expertise really does count here. It's like saying to a pilot, well, you landed the plane and it all seems pretty simple. It can be done. It needs some professional quality and experience to measure it in an effective and persuasive way.
Frank Torres, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, is this going to completely turn Visit Florida upside down, or is it just going to be a fact that going into 2017 and beyond with Richard Corcoran at the helm and some new ideas about transparency, there will be more scrutiny on Visit Florida and other state agencies?
Well, I think the big turning point for Visit Florida will be who will be the replacement. I mean, who's going to come in and what kind of promises he's going to make as far as transparency go. I will say with the Sexy Beaches video, I've watched it twice, once before this Visit Florida controversy and once this morning, actually, before you know, we did the spot. And it really does play out like a commercial. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Miami skyline is featured it's very evident there. The beaches are it does look like it could be a tourism commercial. So, you know, it's just a fascinating story that, you know, really pushes pop culture against analytics and transparency that really does, you know, draw so much interest and hits to the heart of Florida's, you know, main economy. So,
what about the lyric? The catchphrase, sexy beaches and hotels, sounds a little bit like an afterthought, right?
Yeah, it does sound like a little bit like an afterthought. But, you know, I don't know how many of Pitbull's lyrics I can actually recite here. But, you know, there is definitely an angle towards the Florida tourism industry.
But again, we shouldn't get so focused on the titillation factor and, you know, it's Pitbull. The issue is whether it's effective or not. All of us can judge whether we like classical music or whether we like rap music. That's not what the issue is. The issue is whether public money was spent effectively or not.
As part of the problem, too, Hank, it takes a little bit of time to do these surveys effectively and gather the data. Like, by the time that information had been gathered in, the hype and the fury has already exploded. So how do you make sure you have enough time to get an idea of whether your campaign is working or not?
Well, there are metrics that you use, that we use, as campaigns are progressing. So it's not as if you just wait till the end. And you have pretesting, and you have analogs that you used previously to determine whether celebrity was useful in the context of the thing you're promoting.
Mm-hmm. Frank Torres, I'm wondering if you can see some other cases where there is this issue of the privacy of state spending under this auspice of commercial sensitivity. And I'm wondering if you can think of some other contracts that might be under the spotlight now this Pitbull thing is blown wide open.
You know, the no pun intended, but the sexiness of the story involving the celebrity and the whole, you know, backdrop of the controversy is what really is really bringing this to the forefront. There are hundreds of contracts at all levels of government that you could probably question as far as effectiveness and whether the money was probably spent. Things like infrastructure projects, roads, bridges to nowhere. You know, there's so many. There's a lot of empty space between some of those contracts, which are written out between, you know, private entities and governments. And there's always going to be questions asked over how the money is spent.
And then there's the same kind of questions that can be asked over the conduct of public entities and their production of goods and services. And one of the biggest is education. It's one of the biggest industries in the state. It's basically a public entity. We question it. We measure it. But still, you know, there are lots of questions about it.
Hank, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Visit Florida. And I'm wondering just how much of a focus was there on tourism promotion by the state under perhaps Governor Jeb Bush or Governor Charlie Crist?
Well, we already had Visit Florida by the time Jeb Bush was in office. I was on Jeb Bush's Council of Economic Advisors. And I remember when we had 9/11. It was a horrible event. And we thought about, you know, our country, but we also thought about our state, and we also thought about our tourism industry and what things should be done. And to his credit, Governor Bush decided that we should ramp up tourism and promotion and let people know that Florida was still open and still in business. And as sad as we all are, we're safe here. And that was very important.
Final thoughts, Frank Torres. Do you think that maybe Governor Rick Scott would have asked Will Seckham to step down had Pitbull not tweeted out his contract?
I think all of this starts with a Speaker of the House, Richard Corcoran. I think this is a new play or a new demonstration of what the Florida legislature will be like under partially his leadership. And I think it was just a mixture of the personalities involved and the way the story all came down that really made this a big story. And, you know, it'll bring up more questions in the future, but a lot of it's going to depend heavily on who the replacement is and what the new reinvested mission will be moving forward.
Hank Fishkind, do you have some thoughts on who would make a good leader of that agency?
Someone who is very brave and strong,
right,
and rather transparent would be useful.
Well, Hank Fishkind is an economic analyst. You'll hear him every week on 90.7 News. Thank you for joining us, Hank.
Thank you, Matt.
Also joined by Frank Torres, political analyst. Frank, thanks so much for coming in.
Always great to be here.
Still to come, a veteran at UCF's Business Incubator wants to help other veterans turn their business ideas into reality with a course that includes a Shark Tank-like competition. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. This January, veterans who want to start their own business will be offered free training on how to do it. Ricardo Garcia is a U.S. Air Force veteran who now works for the University of Central Florida's Business Incubation Program. Garcia and the program's director, Gordon Hogan, sat down with us to explain what veterans can expect from the 15-week entrepreneurship course. Ricardo Garcia, tell me about this program. What are you trying to achieve with it?
Yeah, so the Veterans Florida Entrepreneurship Program, our goal is to help veterans explore entrepreneurship or those veterans that have an idea or are at the startup phase, get them through and help them further develop their business models and develop a good value proposition, engage their potential customers, validate whatever idea or product or technology they may be developing, and just make them help them succeed in entrepreneurship.
So. Mm-hmm. So, Gordon Hogan, you're the director of UCF Business Incubation Program. What kind of skills do you need to teach people to make their businesses work?
Well, experience in starting your own business or working for a startup is valuable. But you also need work experience, even if you're working for a larger company. It helps just to understand. But startups are different because mm-hmm. you have... when you start a business, it's kind of crazy for a while. A lot going on, and things go up and down every day, and you're struggling with the financial side of it and getting a product out on the market. So it's interesting. I've been involved with the incubation program since it started 17 years ago. So my boss, Dr. O'Neill, started it, and I've been active with him in getting it going.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, 4 or 5 years ago, we said, let's do something to support veterans, because we had quite a few veterans in the program, but we didn't have any formal program to help them. So we got started on that, and it's been a lot of fun. These two mm-hmm. guys have both done a lot to bring it along. You know, Ricardo and Rafael both have been major parts of it, and we had an initiative that we started on our own, but then this opportunity came along for us to participate in a program put out by the state of Florida for mm-hmm. veterans, and it's more formalized. And so I think it's going to be more productive than what we had, even though we got some pretty good businesses started by veterans
mm-hmm.
in our initiative.
Rafael, so if you're going into this program as a veteran, what are you going to get at the end of it? Do you get a diploma?
Yes, we'll have a certificate, but I think the important thing is to hopefully get you further along enough to where you can execute on your idea and incorporate as a business, and then we can help you thereafter with coaching or perhaps becoming a client of the incubator and help you scale the business. So.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we ultimately want. At the end of the program, we're going to do a business competition, business pitch competition. And so hopefully if we're able to get some support from the community, and we can have a little bit of funding to give the winners of that competition, that way they have something tangible they can use as seed funding for their business. So
it's kind of like Shark Tank, is it?
It'll be like a mini Shark Tank, I guess you could call it. Mm-hmm. So.
Gordon, what's different about veteran business initiatives compared to business initiatives from the civilian world or startups from the civilian world?
There's a couple of differences, but one thing that really is a challenge with veterans is a lot of them haven't really thought too much about starting their own business. So we're not trying to sell them on the idea of starting one, but we are trying to separate those out that would like to start one and are interested in it to go through our course, and then they can make a real good decision about starting it, because mm-hmm. it's a challenge, you know.
What was the most tricky thing for you, Ricardo, about drawing down and coming back?
Yes, great question. So I think for me and for many veterans that I've talked to is the transition, transitioning out of the military. I joined the Air Force at 17, and that's all I ever knew. So when I got out, you know, you go to several briefings, and they just dump information of what the civilian world is going to be like and career services and all kinds of things. And then it happens, and you're kind of on your own. So it's kind of a big shocker adjusting to the civilian world and also translating your skills into the civilian marketplace. Even something as simple as putting together a resume can be a challenge. So that was the biggest challenge for me. So I know some veterans want to take the entrepreneurship route, but aren't sure what it all takes. And so hopefully programs like this will help. So.
And have you had a lot of interest in it so far?
We have. So we have about 80 veterans signed up for the program. Hopefully the class will be about 40 veterans this time around, maybe a little bit more. But we intend to continue doing this moving forward. So
this is a pilot program, but you're going to keep it going?
Yes, that's the plan. Yeah. So we were selected as a network partner by Veterans Florida, which is out of Tallahassee, along with other seven higher education institutions through the state. And so, yeah, our goal is to continue this and grow this and hopefully expand the program. So.
Mm-hmm. And is it like grant funding? Like, is that how you're able to get the program off the ground? They give you the seed money to get it going?
Yes. So, yeah, they give you the, I think we got $85,000 in funding to do mm-hmm. this program. So,
Gordon, does that sort of recur every year or do you have to reapply for it? How does that work?
We'll probably have to reapply for it because they're going to watch the first round of it and see how it goes. But we know what we're doing relative to helping veterans because of the incubation program. So I think we have a very good chance of getting it, even maybe enlarging it a bit to where it covers a larger area. But we'll do well with it. We're really pleased that we've had the interest level that we've had because we know there's a lot of veterans out there, and we know there's a significant number of them that would like to start their own business, but how do you reach them? That mm-hmm. was what the challenge was, and this group, this Florida State of Florida group has really been a big benefit to us in that light.
Now, for veterans who sign up to this, is there a classwork component? Do they get mentoring? How does this course work mm-hmm. for them?
Well, you hit both of them. Half of it is classroom type of activities and studying at home, and then some in the classroom and some at home, and then it switches over to more mentoring. And Ricardo can tell you more about the details of it in those two pieces.
Yeah, so we'll have both online and on-site instruction. So the on-site instruction will be taught every other Saturday from 8 to 5 p.m., and then the online instruction will be on a weekly basis, and they'll be tasked to do certain homework, I guess you could call it, and mm-hmm. assignments through the online platform. And then during the on-site instruction, the first part of the class will be bringing a subject matter expert in or just doing a lecture on a certain topic, whether it be finances or customer validation. And then the second portion will be mentoring. We'll bring in mentors and help one-on-one with the veterans.
There's a certain amount of routine and disciplines that are built into military training too. Does that give your veterans an advantage when it comes to doing a course like this?
I think there is an advantage there. Veterans have a skill. Some of them may not know they have it, but a skill that is taught by the military, and it's leadership. It's the attention to detail and getting the mission done. I think those are some skills that veterans bring to the table.
Gordon Hogan, you talked about the fact that when you came up with the idea of doing something to help veterans who wanted to get into the world of business a few years ago, you realized there was this community in Central Florida and there was a need for that. I'm wondering, too, about the drawdown of troops in Afghanistan. There was talk of this big surge of veterans coming back to Central Florida. Are you seeing that now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there are a lot, and a lot of them have done a lot over there, and some of it pretty scary work, that they do. And so they're coming home, and transition is not easy to move from that type of an environment to the environment that's here. Now, I personally didn't have it. I was in the Army Reserve. This was many years ago, but so I went through all the training part of it, but I never did get never was deployed, so I didn't get any firsthand experience. But I know from talking to veterans, it's a challenge. That transition is probably the toughest part of it. So if we can help with that, and maybe they make a decision, I don't think I want to start my business. What I'd rather do is get a job. Then we'll connect them with someone. We don't help find jobs. We just mm-hmm. start businesses. But we'll help them. We'll direct them to someone that can help them.
Do you have to help them manage expectations too? I mean, if you've gone through something like, say, you've been serving mm-hmm. in Iraq or Afghanistan, and as you say, you've done some pretty tough things, you mm-hmm. may come back here and think, I have this great range of skills. I'm going to get a job in a snap, or I'm going to start my own business just like that. Mm-hmm. Do you have to sort of adjust them to the reality of things here back in the United States?
Well, there's a broad range of people that come back, and some of them that what you're suggesting there it definitely happens. They have a hard time picking what they can do that they would be good at, and they may think they're better at it than they are, but that's true of non-veterans, too. They do the same thing sometimes. A scientist comes out with a PhD in something, and they think, I can start this business and do very well, and they get into it. They find out they can't. So, yes, some veterans are kind of the same way. But Ricardo's point about complete the mission type of thinking is very valuable, because we have some people that meander and quit and mm-hmm. try again and back and forth. They don't stay on it and complete it. And so that part of the military training is very important.
Mm-hmm. Ricardo Garcia, you had an entrepreneurial bug early on, though, right? You had a business you started soon after you signed up?
Yeah, I did. So I was active duty, and I have a passion for aviation. And so I really liked the remote control helicopters at the time. They were just coming out, and I really enjoyed them, but the hobby was expensive, so I decided to start a small e-commerce store, found a manufacturer, and just started ordering in bulk and put them online. I started selling them to my friends and went to a couple small trade shows type of thing, and then and it took off. I mean, it was a good side fun, and I just always kind of had this thing for entrepreneurship. So when I started with the incubator, it was really rewarding. I really enjoyed mm-hmm. Working and engaging with entrepreneurs, and just the plethora of knowledge is great. So,
and this was before we had this massive explosion of the availability of drones, right? I mean, they've really taken off, haven't they?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, this is before even quadcopters were out. I saw it more as a hobby than as a source of income, I guess you could say. I was still trying to finish my first bachelor's, and so I enjoyed it while it lasted.
What else do you think you learn from service in the military that translates well to the world of business?
I think an important thing that is embedded into every active duty member or veteran is the attention to detail, always paying attention to everything. I mean, looking at things thoroughly and executing on orders the way they're supposed to be executed on. And I think leadership, too, is how to be a good leader, or how to work with subordinates and things like that. I think that's a valuable asset as well.
And the course that you've come up with, is this something you wish you'd had access to when you came out of the military?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there's a lot of great programs out there available for veterans, not just in entrepreneurship, other areas as well. But yeah, I would love to be part of something like this when I was transitioning out. It would have been great.
Gordon, I wonder if there are other similar courses in other parts of the country that you've reached out to for inspiration, or is this kind of a one of a kind?
When we first started our own initiative, before this program came along, we did reach out to some others and talked. I personally talked to some. There are a lot of successful incubators that are focused on veterans around. But we learned some things from them. But mostly what we've done is we've done the things that we do for non-vets and do those well, and we figured, hey, if we can do it even better for veterans, then that'll work. And so we've worked on refining it and making it better. We tweaked some things about it to make it more appropriate for veterans, but not a lot of change. The real advantage that this program we have has done is you heard Ricardo say there's 80 people signed up for it. Wow. We wouldn't have seen that on our program. We'd have seen 15 or so, maybe, mm-hmm. that showed an interest. So the state of Florida has a better connection with the returning veteran community than we have, obviously. So that's been a big plus to us.
Mm-hmm. How are they connecting with those veterans, Ricardo?
Yeah, so Veterans Florida is doing an excellent job at marketing to veterans in the community throughout the state. And I think the biggest way that they're reaching out to those veterans is through social media. Social media and also tapping into the transitioning organizations like TAP. So once you transition out of the military, you go through a program called TAP. And so
Is that an acronym? Does it stand for something?
It does. I think it's Transition Assistance Program.
Okay.
And so all active duty members who are transitioning into the civilian world go through that. And now Veterans Florida has tapped into a lot of those throughout the state. We have many military installations throughout the state, and we also have the third largest veteran population in the country. So it's definitely worked.
So, Ricardo, people who want to sign up for this, what do they need to know? Is there an enrollment fee? Is there a deadline?
Yes, so there is no enrollment fee for veterans. The deadline is extended through this week, and you can go on to entrepreneur.veteransflorida.org to apply, and then we will be selecting the veterans for the first class here in the next few weeks.
Ricardo Garcia and Gordon Hogan, thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us. Really appreciate it.
Still to come, Christmas cookies for the homeless and a conversation with humorist Dave Barry about roadside attractions and rock music. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. 4 years ago, a Volusia County nonprofit started a new holiday tradition, Christmas Cookies for the Homeless. This year, 200 packages of cookies have been donated or baked for the homeless. Well, joining me to talk more about the nonprofit is Jenny Kent. She's the Director of Development and Community Relations for Halifax Urban Ministries. Welcome to Intersection.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell me how this Christmas cookie initiative got started, Jenny.
Well, I guess it was just a few ladies who got together. They've been doing it now. I think this is their fourth year, and they just decided to help out the homeless. They thought it would be nice to bring a little bit of joy to them with some Christmas cookies.
So cookies are kind of a tangible symbol of the comfort that people get from the holidays. What other help do you provide for the homeless over the holidays that might be different from what you all are doing the rest of the year?
Well, during the holidays, we too have something that we usually get together. We package something for them, whether it's socks and things that they need, like just some soap and some, you know, toiletries, things like that. We'll put together in a package for them and wrap it up like a little Christmas present just for something different. I mean, these are the things that they need all year round, but it sure is nice to get it wrapped up in a bow. So makes a difference.
And as far as the cookies go, are you still asking for donations or still looking for people to bake stuff for you? Or is that particular mission done for now?
That mission is just those two ladies that put that together. So it was just one of many things that have been happening throughout the holidays for us. We on Saturday, I picked up half a van full of canned goods from a lady who had her whole neighborhood participate in putting together a Christmas tree made out of canned goods. She decorated the whole thing with a garland and had a star on top that said love, and just her and her whole family and the whole neighborhood got together, and they filled half a van with food.
Do you also have a food pantry for folks who might just be struggling to get by, have a home, but they still need a little bit of help, you know, over the holidays?
Yeah, we have two types of things that we do here at Halifax Urban Ministries. One of those is to help the homeless. It's homeless intervention, and that's some of the things you're hearing, just where we're helping them out with. We have showers for them. We have hot meals that we serve every day. We serve about 200 meals a day, 7 days a week. Those are all for the homeless. We have computers that they can use. We give out clothes. But for our folks that are already living in a home, we have what we call homeless prevention. And we give out 40-pound bags of food. We give out with that some frozen meat and some produce. And that's for like a family of four. They can eat for a week on that. So that money that they save in the grocery store, they can then take that and use it to pay rent and keep themselves in housing.
Can you give me a sense, Jenny, of the kind of demand you've had for your homeless prevention kits over the last couple of years? Like, is there growing demand for that?
Well, we gave out, as far as Bridge of Hope, our hot meals, we did 96,000 meals last year. And as far as our Feed a Family program, which is what we call our bags, we gave out 24,960 bags a month and about 1 million pounds of food altogether. We also are going into the school systems now, so we've got bags in the schools.
Do you help out providing lunches as well, or is it more you're reaching out to the families through the school and helping them out with the groceries they need at home?
We're reaching out to the families through the school, and the groceries are then picked up there, and so they've got the groceries to take home for the weekend. We're working with an agency called Food Brings Hope, and they are the ones who coordinate with the schools for us.
Now, you checked off a pretty long list of things that people who come to you for help are in need of: clothing, showers, internet access. I see there's also ID applications you help out with. Is there something that Halifax Urban Ministries isn't providing right now but that you see a need for and you would like to in the future?
Well, you know what we need most this time of year is just for people to help us out donation-wise. We have all of these things that we provide, and we just need some more resources in order to be able to do the things that we do now. So really, as far as that goes, it's just people helping us out with donations, not as much in kind as much as, you know, just helping us out with resources, being able to write a check or send some money.
Mm-hmm. What about mental health, too? Because I see that that's one of the things that Halifax Urban Ministry helps out with. What goes on there for helping people out with mental health issues?
When they come to our center, we have both Halifax Health, who helps out with regular illness, like just small things, you know, like cuts and abrasions and things like that. And they're also able to monitor people that have diabetes or heart issues. But they'll give them cards to go to the health center here locally, and they'll help them get ID cards to be able to go there, even though they're indigent and not able to pay. And then on top of that, we have Stuart Marchman, who's worked with us in the past. They have somebody that will meet with people and help out with mental health.
And is there a big need for that from the community that you serve?
Oh, definitely. For the homeless individuals, that's really a big need. There's a lot of mental health. There's also substance abuse issues. Some of why they're homeless is caused directly from mental health issues and that type of thing, substance abuse.
Jenny Kent, I'm reading too that there's some progress being made in the Daytona Beach area in getting a family shelter opened. How big a difference will that make once there's a new shelter opening up there?
It's going to make a huge difference. We're going to be opening up what we call Hope Place, and that's going to be twice as much capacity as what we have now. So right now we have about 24 rooms, and we helped about 96 families last year. When we go there, we're going to have 26 rooms for emergency. We're going to have 10 transitional apartment units, and then we're also going to have 32 beds for unaccompanied youth. That's youth without a mom or dad.
And is that a change in the way homeless services have been provided in the past as far as trying to look at the whole family and even youth rather than individuals?
Yes, we're going to be adding to what we do now. We will be able to have those transitional apartment units, which will really be different. That'll be, you know, family units living together, being able to live in an apartment situation. And then there'll also be the unaccompanied youth that we have not been able to serve in the past. That'll be a new serving for us.
Mm-hmm. Do you get the sense, Jenny Kent, that people who work in this area are sort of coming together and figuring out a more long-term solution to helping these people out?
Yes, people really are working on that. One thing that is greatly needed, you talked about the individuals. We do need some type of shelter for the individuals. We are working on rehousing. We rehouse the families right now. We've got grants to do that. We've also just recently gotten grants to help the individuals. But shelter is a problem for the individual, you know, men and women that are out there. There is not a good shelter here in Volusia County. So there's been a lot of meetings, a lot of talk, and it's just trying to get everybody to come together, the city, the county, everyone to agree on where that shelter will be and how it'll be run.
Finally, I wonder if there's something you would like people listening to this interview to take away when they think about the homeless and the less fortunate over the holidays. What would it be?
Well, just that, you know, while you're out and celebrating and being with your friends and family, just to remember those that are less fortunate than yourself and be able to give back to the community of these people that just really need help. And they can go to our website, which is halifaxurbanministries.org, and definitely see some more information there.
Well, Jenny Kent is the Director of Development and Community Relations at Halifax Urban Ministries based in Volusia County. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having us on.
For his most recent book, Miami Humorist, Dave Barry took a road trip through Florida, visiting some of the roadside attractions he says give the state its charm. I talked to Dave Barry back in August about his book, Best State Ever, A Florida Man Defends His Homeland. Dave Barry, thank you so much for joining me.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So when people talk about Florida man, and sometimes it's Florida is the butt of jokes, does that get you a little bit defensive?
Yeah, yes and no. It's sort of, for many years I've been defending Miami, which even before Florida got its reputation, Miami was considered, a hellhole of crime and craziness. So I was sort of used to both making fun of it myself, but also defending it sometimes, tongue in cheek. And then I think it dates back really to the 2000 presidential election. But in recent decades, Florida, the whole state, has become sort of the laughingstock of the United States. And I get it. An amazing amount of stupidity and weirdness occurs in this state. Stupidity and weirdness maybe are two greatest natural resources. But I just thought it would be fun to kind of defend it a little bit, point out that first of all, a lot of that stupidity and weirdness is committed by people who came from other states that make fun of Florida, but they end up moving here. And also that beneath that veneer of weirdness, there's sort of a charm to the state. I kind of wanted to talk about that in this book.
Mm-hmm. And you took a bit of a road trip as well. I mean, some of the places you visit, like Gatorland in Orlando and Wikiwachee. You wrote about Wikiwachee. It's dated, hokey, unsophisticated. In other words, it's great. Are there some other roadside attractions that didn't quite make it into your book you wanted to write about too?
There are probably dozens and dozens. I didn't get to a lot of them. One of the things I talk about in the book is how that Florida is a state that was sort of built on roadside attractions. That's been sort of displaced by much bigger roadside attractions like Disney World. And now more and more people just come and skip over everything else, go straight to a destination like Disney World, spend their week there, their money there, and then go home and miss out on the rest of the state. So I wanted to talk, as you say, about some of the ones that are still around, Wikiwachee being one of the oldest ones, where women put on mermaid tails and swim around underwater breathing from hoses. And it's hokey, but it's really charming. It's like you're going right back 50 years when you set foot in that place. And some of the places are much sketchier than that. I talk about the Skunk Ape Research Center out in the Everglades in a little tiny dot of a town called Ochapi, which is more in the category of just, you know, sketchy, hucksterish place, but still has a charm and is sort of the spirit of old Florida. Places like that, I think, are doomed, and I kind of want to talk about some of them anyway before they are gone.
Mm-hmm. So you think Florida is losing a bit of its weirdness the more people who move here?
Definitely not losing its weirdness. If anything, its weirdness is increasing because there are a lot more people here than there used to be, and they seem to be behaving more weirdly than they used to just by population pressure. So the weirdness is still here. It's just transforming slowly from strange, exotic wildlife, flora and fauna to people, weird people.
Mm-hmm.
We seem to have an abundance of those.
Let me ask, too, about, you know, what got you started in your journalism career. I mean, what brought you down to Florida in the first place?
I was writing a newspaper humor column in my spare time. I lived in a bucolic little town in Pennsylvania. I had been a newspaper guy for a while, but I had left the newspaper business and was teaching effective writing seminars, but writing a weekly humor column. And gradually that column got into more papers, and it became syndicated in sort of a small scale. One of the first big papers to start using my column was the Miami Herald. And back in the early 80s, they called me up and said, would you, consider working for us? And I flew down to Miami. I'd never been to Miami, and from this little town in Pennsylvania. And I looked around, and this was the height of the cocaine cowboy era. And a lot of good things have happened to Miami since then. Back then, it was a much rougher town. There had been riots fairly recently. Crime was on the increase. The drug problem was drug dealing problem was huge, and Miami was the epicenter of it. And I said, I'm not moving here. I'm not. And the Herald, the Miami Herald, decided to hire me anyway. So for 3 years, I was the Miami Herald's humor columnist, but I lived in suburban Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. But during those 3 years, I started. I came down fairly often, 4 or 5 times a year, to do stories and to just meet with my editors. And I got to know Miami better, and I came to like it, and then I came to love it. And so in 1986, I chose to move to Miami, and I've been here ever since. And a lot of the things that people criticize about Miami are valid criticisms. The traffic here is awful. Drivers are unbelievably bad. There is crime. It's like any big city. I don't know that it's much worse than any other big city, but there is crime. And there can be cultural conflicts here. We have a lot of different cultures mixed together. But there's so much wonderful stuff about Miami. It's a beautiful city. Parts of it anyway are. And I love the Latin flavor of the culture. It's a fun-loving party city. And I think of it as home now.
Now, you also mentioned in the book a couple times that you play in a band called the Rock Bottom Remainders. I wonder if you just talk a little bit about that.
Sure. I'm in a band of we are called the Rock Bottom Remainders. And when everybody's there, which is infrequent, but it does happen occasionally, it's some pretty good writers: Stephen King, Amy Tan, Scott Turow, Roy Blunt Jr., Ridley Pearson, Greg Isles. Oh, man. Mitch Albom. Bunch of good authors. We're not a good band. we're a pretty bad band. Some of the people are actually decent musicians, but we don't practice, which is probably the reason we're not a good band. But we have fun, and we've become good friends. We've raised a bunch of money for literacy causes, and so we keep playing. Every now and then we get together, although I can't say by popular demand, because there really is no popular demand for our music, which... The genre has been described, Roy Blunt Jr. calls it hard listening music. That's us.
Do you perform original stuff, or do you do covers? What do you play?
Mostly old rock songs. And when I say old, I mean really old. So old that, that we actually remember them from when we were kids. We do occasionally do original tunes. I wrote a song called Tupperware Blues, which we perform. It's a blues song about Tupperware, as you might imagine from the title. And I believe it's the only blues song ever written about Tupperware. For what that's, it leads the world in that category. And we do a couple of other original songs, but we generally prefer to do songs that are so familiar to most people that even when we play them, they recognize what it is.
That interview with Dave Barry first aired on Intersection in August. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Talia Blake. You can find this show and previous episodes on our website, wmfe.org/intersection, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.